This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Eric Broyles has experienced all the highs and lows that life can bring. He grew up rough in Hamilton's inner city, and he didn't see much of a future for himself. But others did. After Broyles was taken under the wings of mentors whose helpful guidance changed his path, he graduated from college and then law school, and he went on to become successful in business and law. And he recently wrote a check for $1 million to the University of Cincinnati Blue Ash, his alma mater. Eric Broyles is now CEO of Expert Connect in Washington, D.C. He joined me in the studio recently to talk about his path. Eric Broyles, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You've had quite a life's experience. I want to start first with this $1 million donation to the University of Cincinnati's Blue Ash campus. This money is designated for scholarships. And I want to know why that was important to you.
So it was important to me because when I was a student at UC Blue Ash during my first year, I actually worked a full-time job and for the first year only worked a part-time job as well. So I worked during the day, I studied late at night, and then I had an overnight shift as a janitor from 3 a.m. until 7 a.m. for my first year. So the brutality of that motivated me to help other students who have to work. So that's part of the criteria to receive funds from the endowment. But I don't want other students to have to work overnight and so they can get some sleep. And so that was really important to me.
To help offset some of that extra stress that full-time working students have to face.
Absolutely.
When you think back to your early life, was there a moment where you had a vision or a dream of, you know, one day I'm going to write a big check to something or to somebody? Did you have that moment?
I did. The first time I started thinking about being able to help people was when I was very young, and I'd actually gotten into some trouble in my hometown up in Hamilton, and I was on probation. I was 9 or 10 years old at the time. It was during that time that I started to think about how do I help kids like me not get in these situations. And as I matured, it crystallized for me ways in which I might help others. And so I knew that education was critical to that. I knew ultimately that business was critical. I think about the gentleman here in Cincinnati that I worked for in college. They were business people. One, I worked at a garage door company called Salem Door, and then I worked at AE Door. And Bill Weber was a well-known local entrepreneur here. I think about the impact he had on my life by telling me, hey, I'm actually going to let you cut your hours some the next 2 years so you can focus on your school, and I'll pay you the same, right? He was able to do that because he was an owner. So as I matured, I realized the importance of business. And yes, by the time I finished law school, it was kind of set in my heart that most of the wealth I create for myself, I'm going to share with others.
And so you had that moment. You got to do this just for you personally. And we know this is going to help some people. But for you personally, what did that feel like?
Fulfillment of purpose. First of all, I'm a Christian. So in my faith teaching, giving is significant. You're supposed to give and support. And so fulfilling what is important to me. And it actually just feels like what I'm supposed to do.
Success wasn't always associated with you, and you started to touch on this from your upbringing in Hamilton. I read a profile about you in the Journal News. It reported that you graduated near the bottom of your class in 1987 at Baden High School. What were your struggles then?
Yeah, I think I was second from the bottom, to be exact.
My apologies.
Yeah, I was a D student in high school. I think there were many things impacting me. I think, one, I went to a school that was not very diverse. So I encountered issues that you encounter when you're in an environment where not everyone embraces diversity. Let's just put it like that. And then I think there were some macro issues going on in the Southwest Ohio area at the time. The GM plant closed while I was in high school. My dad worked at Armco Steel, which is now AK Steel, for 36, 37 years. That plant shrunk its footprint by more than half. And so I started seeing around me a displacement of people who had previously worked. And then to have a perfect storm, you had the crack epidemic arise then. So it was really hard even to focus because I saw people that I grew up with succumb to addictions. And literally the community, it felt like it changed overnight. You know, it was a working class, poor neighborhood, but good people who worked hard, took care of their lawns and a sense of pride in the neighborhood. And then to see that kind of just almost change overnight, where it was this epidemic of people being addicted to crack and people selling crack. All of those things were going on around me. It was hard to sort of ignore it. So it was hard to focus.
So what was Hamilton like then for you in terms of your upbringing? I mean, what impact did it have on you as you were just a young student?
My community where I lived in what's called the second ward of Hamilton, and I felt like I had a great community. I love the people in my community. I had a lot of elders in that community that I looked up to. In fact, I'm giving a speech at a local community center and going to honor some of the people who I felt really helped me set the foundation of my life. And a lot of those people were in that community. And they were not lawyers or doctors, but they're great people that I love and thankful to them for what they poured into my life. But during this time, you think the 80s, it's a very segregated community. And so there were racial tensions and strife and things like that that you dealt with. And so I think anyone who's paying attention will be impacted by those things.
So despite those struggles, whether it be in the community or in the classroom for you, you made it to college anyway. You started at UC Blue Ash. How were you able to overcome all of those struggles and put yourself on this path to success?
I think a few things happened. One, prior to starting in the fall, I had the opportunity to work installing garage doors for one of the garage doors.
Yeah, companies. You talked about this and the assistance that they gave you. So you had this mentor-like relationship.
Yeah, so the mentorship was great, but the experience of, you know, working in 100-degree weather, putting in garage doors, I knew that I needed to give myself an opportunity to do something else. Nothing wrong with that. I respect people who do that type of thing, but I knew I could have a different impact in the world if I got the proper tools, the education. So for me, I had a vision of becoming successful. I had a vision of empowering other people. And I knew that for me, that probably would come through law, becoming a lawyer, and then business. And so that concept crystallized for me by the time I was a freshman at University of Cincinnati. And so I just had a resolve to do what it takes to make it.
And so you're giving out scholarships now, and you cited a couple of early scholarships that you got in your early days of undergraduate work. What were those?
Yeah, so leaving high school, my church gave me a scholarship clearly based on mercy, not my academic prowess, but because I was an active student in the church, and I was going to college. So they supported me. They gave me a small scholarship, and that was helpful. And then as I got into the flow and really started to enjoy academics and the environment at University of Cincinnati, and I just started excelling. I just got A's all the time, right? And I just, in that just sort of momentum just built on itself.
And I wanted to talk about those A's because another factor here is that your old boss, his name was Bill Weber at the garage door company. He wanted to see your report cards.
He did.
So he was holding you accountable.
He was.
Okay. And so it must have felt good for you after those D's that you were making at Baden to turn in a report card that had all those A's on it.
It did. And it just further motivated me because the trade-off for Bill Weber and I was I made a good salary as a college student. I made probably just short of, you know, $30,000 a year as a college student. My hours shrunk from my first year where I worked 50 hours a week to working by the time I was a senior, junior and senior, 25 to 30, and I made the same. So the trade-off for that economics that he provided me was that I had to succeed because that's what he was investing in.
So I think in entrepreneurship or lots of areas, like fitness comes to mind, an instructor or a teacher or a parent might say to you, you have to hold yourself accountable. But how important is it to have someone else hold you accountable to?
Critical. And I think that can come in many forms. oftentimes I speak to UC students and I tell them, that take a look around at the five people you spend the most time with. You're going to be an average of those five people. And so that is a form of accountability. Who do you have relationships with? It could come through the form of mentorships. It could come in the form of, you know, for me as a Christian, I belong to various groups where we have accountability partners to make sure we're living out our faith in a certain way. So it can come in many forms, family. But yes, I'm thankful that I had people to hold me accountable. I have several mentors. And then likewise, I mentor, I don't even know how many, a lot of, you know, I mean, I probably, if I look at my week and I put in 70 to 80 hours a week still, probably 10 to 15 of it is in mentorship.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking with Eric Broyles. He's an alumnus of the University of Cincinnati and recently gifted $1 million to the Blue Ash campus to help students with scholarships. So in 92, you graduated from UC. And so this is 5 years after you were second from the bottom at Baden High School in Hamilton. But by the time 1992 rolled around, you graduated summa cum laude from UC. You delivered the valedictory speech. You were recognized as the most outstanding business student. Quite a turnaround. And then you went on to the University of Virginia. You earned a law degree. You went into corporate law. You worked for AOL, Time Warner, some other large organizations. When you got out of the Cincinnati area and you started to see more places, what impact did that have on your outlook, both like in general or professionally?
I think exposure to different places, environments is just good for us all in general. It was eye-opening for me. It allowed me to really see how big and vast the world is and to see what's possible. And I started to have different types of relationships. I'll just give you an example. When I was a senior here, I was grateful to meet Mr. Carl Lindner, who I thought was a great man. But I didn't develop a relationship with him. Now that I'm in Washington, I have relationships with several billionaires who appear much higher on the Forbes list than he did. And no slight on him, but I don't know if I would have had the access that I have in life right now, the business partnerships I'm in. I don't know if people would have looked at me and said, yeah, I see that in you. I'm going to invest in you. But when I look at my network now, it's vast and expansive and global. I even force myself now to spend about a month outside of the U.S. a year just so that I can further broaden my perspective. In 2017, I did Asia for about a month. Last year, it was Europe, where I spent a lot of time. I do the Middle East. And so it enables me to really understand the breadth of humanity. And that it was Torrens, the playwright, that said, all of us are human, therefore nothing is alien to us, right? Because we're all human at a core. And when you travel and when you open yourself up to the possibilities of relationships to different types of people, people who look different from you from a color or from a race or a religious perspective, you start to understand the depth of the commonality of humanity. And so that's just a lesson that I've learned, and it's richly bless my life.
How do we ensure that more younger Americans get that experience? Because I think that's something, I mean, if you've been to Europe, you've spent time in Europe, it's not unusual for Europeans to travel around. It's a lot more compact to see other countries there, but it's unusual for Americans to be able to get out and see other cultures. How do we fix that?
You know, I think you have opportunities to do those things in educational institutions. So I do think colleges and high schools sort of tackle that issue to some extent with, you know, exchange programs and things like that. But I also think it comes from community as well. So, for example, the church I grew up in Hamilton, they're taking a trip to Israel for the first time. I've been to Israel several times. I own part of a software company in Tel Aviv. And so I'm proud to be in a position where the place where I got my sort of spiritual roots, when they go to Israel, I have people there who can be there for them, to help them and give them access to places and things that they may need while they're there. And so I think community, I think schools, and then I think stories, narratives. I don't post all my travels on Facebook, but sometimes I post my journeys, so primarily for my family, so they can kind of keep up with me and see what I'm doing. And I think that opens up the possibility. But my own personal commitment to that is I have a little niece who I invest in. I pay for her private school education. And I took her out of the country for the first time. She's only, you know, I think she's 10 years old. And I took her out of the country for her first trip.
I notice you say invest in rather than support or pay for. Why?
Well, investing is I think, broader than support. Support is very important. I can support you emotionally. I can support you in a number of different ways because investing costs. Sometimes support doesn't cost. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to send a text to say, how are you doing? It's less easy to get in your car and drive 2 hours to go see how someone is doing or to get on a plane and fly across country to let someone know that you're there for them or around the world for that matter. And so that's why I say invest, because when you invest, it costs.
I want to talk about a book you wrote, Encounters with Police, A Black Man's Guide to Survival. This book was published in 2015, and in the 4 years since, this topic has been a difficult one for this country after too many questionable encounters between police and unarmed black men. What motivated you to write that?
Yeah, you talk about becoming an accidental author. Well, first, you know, I'm a business person, right? So I don't style myself as somebody who is involved in civil rights, though I think they're important. And in my own way, I guess I'm involved. But I wrote this book just because I thought I had a unique perspective. Here I am. I was angry at when I believe it was Michael Brown or one of the young men who were killed and Trayvon Martin and others, although he wasn't killed by police. I was angry at those incidents. And I had a disconnect because my best friend who I grew up with was a police officer in Hamilton. And I thought, man, how can I have this anger in my heart towards police officer, my best friend, and many of my friends, some of my high school football teammates are police officers and sheriff deputies. And so I knew they're good people. And I realized it was just really an understanding gap that existed between most citizens, I think, and law enforcement. And I knew that because I talked to my best friend all the time about his day and I heard what he had to go through. So we initially had the idea of just writing a pamphlet. And then as we wrote the pamphlet, we said, oh, the kids will just, they'll just throw it away. So let's give them something where they at least feel like they have to hold on to it. So we wrote a short book, and it went viral in 2015. It's sold tens and tens of thousands. I get messages from people across the country. The highest percentage of my messages come from police officers, though, thanking me for writing the book. And they all say, we didn't like the title. I had an officer from Wisconsin once find me on Facebook, and he said, you know, I walked by the library with my 4-year-old and I saw your book and I smirked. And he said, I'm in a small town here. It's not very diverse. And I was just irked by your book. He said, I picked it up from the library. He said, I've read it twice over the weekend. And I just want to tell you that every cop I know in Wisconsin, I'm going to tell them to get your book. And so that was fulfilling. And likewise, I've heard similar stories from young people who feel like they understand these encounters and they understand that they have a way of dealing with them that doesn't have to result in violence or argument, that there's a process for dealing with unfair situations.
What was the main takeaway for readers of that book, especially for the black men in the title?
That if something bad happens to you in a police encounter, you have a right to fight that. You just don't have a right to fight it at the time.
There was a high-profile death of an unarmed black man at the hand of a police officer at the University of Cincinnati. The victim's name was Sam DuBose. The officer's name is Ray Tensing. Did that case have any particular effect on you because of where it happened?
Yes. Obviously, it was impacted because it's my local community. It happened not far from where I lived when I was a student at the University of Cincinnati. And so anytime you have a tragic circumstance like that, we lose a little bit of ourselves.
Do you feel like the needle's moving at all in this conversation about law enforcement and Black Lives Matter in terms of just the national conversation?
I do. I think there have been some advancements. I think we have a lot of work. And again, always it's a shared responsibility. Everybody has to do their part. But I do think things are improving, but still a lot of work to do. This is never going to be a perfect situation where you don't have some of these instances are just bad actors, meaning from the police departments, and some are just maybe mistakes. But ultimately, we all have to kind of keep working to root out the bad actors and educate citizens on how to deal with these situations so that they feel like they have a voice.
So you've been described as a serial entrepreneur, and I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, just to stay on this topic, do you think more business leaders should be involved in commenting on or working for change in social justice issues?
It's an interesting question. I think over the last 5 or so years, you're starting to see more of that. Some people might say, Howard Schultz at Starbucks has spoken out on issues. Michael Bloomberg, obviously, and Ken Frazier, whom I know, CEO of Merck, stepped off of President Trump's council when the Charlottesville incident happened. So I think it's a fine line. Ultimately, you have to think about your shareholders first and your investors. Fortunately, I'm an investor in private companies, so I don't have those restrictions. And my business partners run the gamut from 75-year-old white men who are Republicans and Trump supporters to young folks in the Middle East that I do deals with. And so for me, I pay some attention, but ultimately I have to be true to myself, and I'm going to speak out when I have to. And I've been supported by most of my partners and various business partners in my activism, but it is not my main focus. I'd rather kind of stay behind the radar and spend my time with young people and give them resources to help better their lives.
So a serial entrepreneur, what are some of the things you're working on? You referenced this software project in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
What's that and what else?
Sure. So I have found the interesting thing when I think about like my vision, I couldn't articulate it this way when I was like a 10-year-old or even a 20-year-old. But what I realized as I, matured, certainly by my mid to late 30s, I realized that, my real sort of gift is empowering others, right? And a gift of exhortation and motivating others. And so I've been in several companies, but my biggest financial success has come from where I've identified somebody, and I don't know what the draw necessarily was, and I got behind that person. I did that once with a guy where we invested $1 million. The company went to $1.2 billion in 7 years. The gentleman in Israel who has a software company that basically solves the issue of companies that are in like big manufacturing, like oil companies and things like that. If something goes wrong in your standard operating procedures, the historical way of finding that out was you'd have an SAP, a tablet with SAP, and you'd have to go back to the office to report something. Well, he has a technology that real time keeps compliance with standard operating procedures.
Wow.
But that's about relationship, though. Those are just great relationships I've had, and those relationships are the ones that have enabled me to do some of the things that I do.
We've got to wrap up. If there's another young man or woman stuck in a bad spot, but thinking someday I'm going to get out of this, my life's going to be better, I'm going to be successful, what's the very first step you would advise them to take?
Develop your vision. You have to have something in front of you that you can move towards, because there's going to be a lot of things that are behind you trying to keep you in a certain place. So I think developing your vision and then moving towards that, and then action and execution. You have to move daily towards that vision.
So know what it is that you want.
You have to know what it is. And know who you are and understand who you are. And a lot of us don't do that. Take some time to really figure out who you are and then what is that you want, and then move on it.
Eric Broyles, I really appreciate you taking some time and talking to us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.